I'm very happy now to welcome Martin Stegmuller. He is a teacher and curriculum coordinator for the Leadership and Ethics Program at the St. Mark's School in Dallas, Texas. And we're here to talk about education and ethics. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So when you teach ethics, do you have to first decide and agree on what the values are, what the ethics are that you're teaching?
Yes and no. That's a long, slow process that any school would go through. And as you can imagine, it's potentially a controversial process. One of the huge insights for me, I teach a lot of seniors, and you know, you have these, at our school it's all boys actually, and so I started talking to these boys in depth as they are leaving us, you know, and asking them questions about what's the difference between ethical and unethical action, and what makes a good man a good man, and what makes a leader a good leader. And they didn't really have any answers to those questions. It wasn't that they had five different ones and they couldn't decide between them, which would be sort of a healthy criticality. They just didn't have any answer at all. And these boys are unbelievably gifted. They can explain photosynthesis to you. They're Division I athletes. They're incredible violinists. They could explain lots of things to you, and they can't even begin to give answers to those questions. And so I think historically, like in the last 40 years or so, humanities education, sort of in the wake of Vietnam and terrible government malfeasance, their sort of their attitude has been the big danger is dogma. So the key is leave everything up to individual people to decide. And from my perspective as a teacher, though I have great respect for that instinct, I think we've gone way over in the other direction, and that by not ever leading the kids toward any answers that wise, thoughtful people have realized are vital to living in the world well and taking care of the world, by leaving it completely up to each kid, right? Where they think, oh, well, just the ethical is whatever anybody says it is, which is sort of what they believe.
Or what everybody else is doing.
Right.
Which is peer culture.
Right. And so that has been the impetus to get a critical mass of faculty at our school to go, that's really not acceptable. And so we've done a lot of thinking and a lot of work on trying to come up with, yes, what do we want our boys to know when they leave us? And that's the beginnings of, you know, there's just a trade-off between how detailed answers you come up with and how many faculty are on board and things like that.
So what do you actually do? I mean, the faculty have gotten together and discussed these very interesting and deep questions, and then you bring it back to the young people. How do you, like, do you have a particular ethics class that's part of the curriculum?
We don't have a class called ethics. Certain teachers who are sort of at the edge of this all teach a great bit of ethics themselves in their courses. It's still at our school a bit hit and miss depending on what teacher you have, and that's sort of by design. I mean, the idea was if early in trying to establish a program like this, you start having one class or one person or two people who are in charge of this, everybody else sort of gets off the hook, right?
Yeah, it becomes compartmentalized.
Right. So we really stress the cultural aspect of it at the school. We want an ethical leadership culture at our school where there's a stress on small ball, if you will, small ball leadership.
Small ball?
Small ball, like in baseball, small balls like bunts and singles as opposed to home runs.
Okay.
And so part of the issue at a school where you're trying to teach leadership is that you might have 30 or 40 authority positions for students to have, but you have 850 students. So that's a problem if you're going to say, oh, we're teaching leadership to our students. Are you only teaching it to 4% of your students? And so we've really thought through what that word means, like what is a leader? And so part of the cultural dimension is we want every kid to see that all the time they're in English class, we want them to understand that as a micro community that has a mission and that they can affect that positively, neutrally, negatively. We want them to be cognizant. They're walking onto campus. This is a school that supports them. This is a school that gives them their identity as a student, as an athlete. Their friends are there. We want them to take that very seriously because, again, up until now, they just sort of walk onto campus, right? It's about them. Now it's about the school in a way that it hadn't been before.
So part of ethics is seeing yourself as part of a whole as opposed to a free agent individual.
As we understand it, it is the essential part, right? It is the essential part. So the kids who get this, I mean, we have them, one of the exercises that we have the faculty do and that we have all the students do, we have them draw what we call their web of social connections. And so, you know, the kids will be, who are they? They're sons, they're brothers, they're on this team, they're on that team, they're in this class, they're in robotics club, they're citizens of Dallas, they're, you know, on and on and on. So we draw that out. And then we ask them to gradually erase those, right? And then to look at what they have left. Like, where does the being in their life come from? It comes from the doing through those social roles in those communities. And if those communities aren't healthy, then their own lives are impoverished. So that overlap between the health of the communities that give them the social roles through which they really live their lives and their selves is huge overlap. And when they see that, that changes the whole dynamic of what they consider their self-interest to be versus their social responsibility.
Now, all of that sounds great. You need examples, and presumably you need to not just tell them, but actually have situations that are set up in which they play out roles or really think about things in a more active way.
Sure. And so I guess one of the little just mini exercises that any teacher could do, like at our school, you know, let's say you start getting a little pushback, which we invite for sure. It's the only way to teach kids. Like, they get full status to object to any of this. And they do. And because so many of them, again, they've been taught by culture to think that it's a zero-sum game. They have their own interest and their own energy. And if they give it to somebody else, that's a cost. And we're really trying to correct that. And one of the ways to do it is just to say, if you could be any teacher at the school, who would you be? And the kids inevitably pick one of three or four or five people. And it's telling that they pick pretty much the hardest working, most dedicated, first ones to get there in the morning, last ones to leave people. And so it's just on the front end to be able to go, think of what you just did. You just picked the person who is the most giving person on this campus. What does that mean, right? There's this disconnect between intellectually what you think about things and what you as an experienced person in this community think about things. And then just to start asking them, you know, someday, again, we have all boys, you're likely to be a dad. You're planning on being a dad. You're planning on being a husband. You're hoping to be a boss at work. And to really ask them, is your attitude toward your son someday going to be, how little can I put into this to get out the most? Which is the traditional cost-benefit analysis logic. And of course it's not, right? And so to get them to see, do you think I, as your teacher right now, do you think my goal, would you like my goal to be, how little can I put into this class and still get my paycheck and my raise, you know?
Right.
And they're like, of course not, you know? And so there's examples all over that completely contradict to the standard cost-benefit analysis. So we point to those whenever possible. And because we have a very loving, caring school, I mean, it's fairly easy to get the kids away from that sort of, I don't know what to call it, sort of negative, kind of skeptical stance, and to really go, I'm incredibly lucky and fortunate to be in the world that I'm in. And
love is a word that may not be used all that often in the context of this stuff, but I mean, love is the ultimate example of the more you give, the more you've got. Like,
yes.
You don't ever drain your supply.
Yes.
Maybe some people do if they are working in a refugee camp or something.
Sure.
Like that and get exhausted. But by and large, if you have a somewhat ordinary life, it's like that.
It is. And we talk about love all the time, and we're fortunate enough to have our headmaster, who just retired after 21 great years. I mean, I was stunned when I got to the school. One of the first things he said at the first faculty meeting was, every boy at this school is going to be loved. And every boy needs to be loved. Every teacher needs to be loved. So it was those sorts of attitudes that paved the way for the program in the first place. But to get the kids to be excited about, again, so many of our kids, their dads are businessmen, and that's great. And the kids want to be successful in a traditional way, in a kind of competitive way. But one of the great things we've been able to do through shifting this sort of vocabulary, shifting the logic, we have kids really excited now that they're going to, you know, run businesses where everybody has great health care at their firm. Everybody wants to come to work. Like, we're going to pay 20% more than the going wage. Like, that's going to be the kind of boss I'm going to be. So we view that as a huge positive for the world going forward, that those kids would have had that kind of transformation.
Do you bring issues of race, class, and gender into the mix?
We do, but it's not our focus. I think that's sort of 10 clicks down the river. Our focus is more, once you can get the kid to see how important empathy is, to see how important compassion is, to really have his antenna up when he walks into a room or a team, who needs what here? Who's struggling here? Who's hurting here? We talk about that more generally because we don't think that really gets done elsewhere. I mean, having been through university and grad school and all that, the race, class, gender gets talked about actually quite a bit.
But and not always in ways that's very productive, if I may say so.
Right. Well, I think I would hope that having a kid turned on to the bigger issues would then allow the race, class, and gender talk that comes further down the line to make more sense and to realize that, wow, there might be chronic ways that an organization might actually not do well by certain types of people, and to be aware of that, where even if it doesn't feel like it to him, there's still these odd dynamics going on, that would be great. But the first step, if you don't have a kid who even cares that somebody is being oppressed, what good will it do to point out that certain people are oppressed, right? So our focus is on that front end issue, where we want people to take ownership, like a proprietor of a great restaurant, right, who greets you at the door, and the attitude is, this is my space, and everybody in this space is going to have a great time, and if not, that's on me.
Right.
We want them to view themselves that way all the time.
We're talking to Martin Stegmuller, who teaches ethics at St. Mark's School in Dallas, Texas. And of course, Dallas, Texas is a kind of money capital of the United States, and a place where it is so stratified. And I wonder, I mean, this whole question, and I've thought about this a great deal as I have gone through life and realized that I was never taught ethics. I mean, my parents loved me, but we never had these conversations about what do we mean when we say we? Do we mean the family? Do we mean the school? Do we mean the city? Do we mean the country? Do we mean the world? Do we include plants and animals and water and air and land? Like, do we include the entire biosphere? These are questions that were never asked and that I think a lot of people in our generation have had to ask ourselves and educate ourselves about. And if you're doing that in school, you're a step ahead. Do you talk about, for example, living creatures?
We do. We try to talk about it in terms of concentric circles of responsibility. And so to really ask the boys, which of your communities supports you the most and most directly? And those are at the core of the circle, right? So their family, in most cases, does the most for them. We then think that the boy should have a huge focus on giving reciprocal care to that community that supports him. And we view it that way. So family, school, friends, church, synagogue, temple, mosque, whatever it is for that boy, or if there is anything there. But the city of Dallas, like, to really get them to realize, what if Dallas is broken as a city? What does that mean about your school? What does it mean about your parents' careers? What does it mean about your future career? And to get them to go, wow, you know, my interest in Dallas interests are, there's a real connection there. Is it as close to their family? Do we want them spending as much time tending to Dallas as they do to their own parents and brothers and sisters? No. But we want it to really understand that that's a real concern. America, how about America? Similar, right? Dallas is probably more important to their day-to-day lives than America, but America has to be healthy too. And then we're going to ask them to think about, well, what are you going to do? Like, you can vote at a minimum. You can stay aware at a minimum. And then some of the kids are going to have more opportunities to be bigger caregivers there. And I think, you know, interestingly, we are now at a point clearly where global citizenship is a real thing, and every decision everybody makes in the world, like it's China's decisions to build coal power plants, have effects on everybody, right? And our decisions to allow whatever policies we allow, they affect everybody. So again, that's circle is more on the margin, but that's the way we teach it. Try to be cognizant of how much a community actually holds you together as a person, and give the most care to that community, and then out, out, out.
It's a very interesting case in Dallas and in Texas, where you've got such a world center of petroleum, and you have a potential, well, real conflict between, on the one hand, this is the lifeblood of your city, on the other hand, putting fossil fuels into the air is slowly and surely, or quickly and surely, destroying the biosphere. Big conflict between two things that are really important to these people. What do you do with that?
Good. Again, that's not necessarily directly a focus with the kids. Again, that's sort of a few clicks down the road from where we're trying to deal with them. First of all, it's a bit of a misnomer, maybe based on the show Dallas. Dallas is not in a oil-heavy region of Texas. Houston is much, Houston, Midland. There's other cities, again, this is just a much side issue, but that are much bigger oil and gas cities. We have a decent amount of finance that gets done in Dallas for the oil and gas industry. Like our buildings at our school, you know, every new building has LEED certification at least the silver level, right? It's a huge focus of the school. We have kids that are way into solar. They're so interested in it. We have lots of kids take AP Environmental Science. And again, as you're probably aware, the gas, natural gas, might well be the bridge that gets us from where we are now to allowing solar to really run everything in whatever 5 or 10 or 15 years. And so there's positives about at least the natural gas industry, right? And to try to be realistic about, could we switch away from oil tomorrow, right? That's sort of a, probably the answer would be no.
It seems to me that that's just an example that came to mind because of your location. Mm-hmm. I mean, a friend of mine lives in the Dallas area and worked for the Society of Petroleum Engineers. I mean, it is a, you know, it's not an oil place, right?
Sure.
But whatever the issue is, when you have a conflict between the greater good for others and the greater good for your family, when those things are at odds with each other.
Right. What do you do?
That's what do right. you do, and how do you teach that and address it with people in their teens?
Good. Ours is a combination of sort of Aristotle and Kant, if you're thinking of it theoretically. So we try to get them to see that, you know, we really focus on sustainability as a central value. It's sort of the anchor of our morality side of what we do. So to get kids to see that if their behavior is undermining their ability to keep doing it, if something about what they're doing is actually breaking their ability to keep doing that going forward, there's something illogical and weird about it and bad about it. So
what are examples that come up?
Well, anything from lying, which makes it impossible to tell the truth or lie if you keep doing it, right? To plagiarism, you know, at a school level. That's sort of how we try to focus with the kids. Do you understand it's not in your interest to develop habits where you're not concerned about the impact that your behavior is having on the communities that allow you to have that behavior in the first place? So one example would be, if your behavior is sinking the lifeboat, it's a really bad idea for you to do it, no matter how good it feels in the short run.
Yeah, or eating junk food.
Right, or you know, playing video games all night, or whatever it is, right? And so if ultimately you're polluting the world in such a way that your own ability to, for everybody to thrive and be happy in the world, is also being degraded, then it's irrational, and it's not something you should be doing. And it's not in your interest to do it if you understand your full enlightened self-interest. And we do also focus on, you know, we really try to make a distinction between groups and communities. And so they're not just supposed to be helping their group. I mean, we define ethical leadership as moving your communities forward in their missions. And so obviously there's groups that do very bad things. And so we define communities as people who share a mission and that the people also are concerned about the well-being of everybody in the community. That's a community. So if we're hurting the world by gaining for our own family and our family sits in that world, right? The family's well-being, our children's well-being is also in this greater world, then that's irrational and that behavior shouldn't happen.
Does it work? I mean, do you see kids changing the way they treat others, the way they form their habits?
I think definitely. Obviously, you're talking about 850 kids of wide-ranging backgrounds, and you're talking about, you know, a school whose ostensible mission in the eyes of parents, I mean, most of our parents send their kids to our school. They want them to get a good education, but it's very much a college prep school. There's a lot of focus on getting them ready to apply and get into great colleges. And so all this has to happen in the context of that. And so the historical resource allocation at our school and every such school is devoted toward academics. And so this is a somewhat new piece, right? And it's in competition with the traditional mission of the school.
How is it in competition?
Well, it's in competition in the sense that you can imagine a teacher going, I barely have enough time to get my kids ready to get fives on the AP exam now. And what if now you seem to be asking me to add something to what I'm doing in my classes? I'm a science teacher. I don't teach ethics. So what are you doing? You know, and do you hire somebody to run a program like this? Do you devote that much budgetary money to something like this? Or do you actually start a writing lab so the kids can write better? You know, like there's trade-offs. That's the kind of competition I'm talking about. Ultimately, I mean, the good news is that we think this is hugely, and there's overwhelming evidence, it's hugely college admissions positive, because the kids who have been the first movers in this in the strongest way, I mean, I wish, you know, there was somebody here to talk to you, just one of those kids, because they just get so jazzed. Like, the kids who really see that the best way I can develop as a person is to serve my world with all my heart and energies. I mean, they end up making all these connections in the world. They have great stories to tell. I mean, the college admissions people are like, yes, we want you.
We want
the kid who's going to hit the ground running at our college and make a difference. And so that's what we're teaching the kids to do. So there isn't competition. They're very simpatico in that way. But just on how do you take a situation where the teachers and students felt they're already maxed out and ask them to do something else? That's the competition.
Although I have to say, I mean, trying to do it in math would be a little tricky. Trying to do it in science where you've got a lot of science to learn. Yeah, there's ethics of science, but that's another thing. But I mean, literature, history, philosophy, all those things, that's what you're studying in the first place in a lot of ways.
Right. And so, but the issue we started talking about at the beginning of the conversation is a very live issue. And so, again, the teaching culture in the humanities is very much, yes, read these great books, have great conversations, and our kids do that all the time and have been having them at our school for decades, for sure. And I think at most places. My question has been, and that's been a driver at our school, this question, what happens if at the end of roughly 5,000 hours of humanities education, if a kid's with us from first grade through 12th grade, they've had about 5,000 hours, what happens if they're graduating and they can't begin to give answers to these very basic questions?
Right.
And so the question is, are all of these disparate sort of uncoordinated conversations they've been having for 12 years, where are they leading to the efficacy of a person to make a difference in the world? Do they need more coordination where those conversations are being guided toward at least a minimal set of truths that the kid is supposed to learn through that process? Like, I'm in a world and I need to support my communities, right? So you see the potential conflict, say, if you're teaching Ayn Rand or something, and do you allow your goal for that kid's understanding to influence the way you would teach that book? Because quite honestly, humanities teachers have been trained, oh, when you teach that book, you're sort of on the side of the author, right? And you present the case from Ayn Rand's perspective, as it were, and you just sort of ultimately hope that the students will piece this all together themselves and come out in a good space. And I guess my question has been, is it a fair question to our discipline to ask, is it working? And my answer would be that strategy, though it's incredibly well-intentioned, isn't working.
Very interesting. We're talking to Martin Stigmuller about teaching ethics to young people, especially in high school. I think that's the age group we're talking about.
1 through 12, we start with young kids too. Yeah.
How do you start with the young ones?
Well, each of our divisions, so there's lower school, middle school, upper school, which is pretty standard. Each of our divisions has its own basic rallying point as a starter. This is how we started the program like 8 years ago. And our lower school's motto is unconditional positive respect. And if there's one thing we want those kids to realize, it's that they pound away at it, right? That every single kid, regardless of difference, regardless in ability and socioeconomic group or whatever, they deserve your respect from the beginning as people. And that's a great basis, right? And then middle school, which is a time, as you probably know, where kids can be really mean to each other and they start forming little cliques that are not very helpful to the bigger group. And our focus is on inclusion, right, in the middle school. There's just an overarching focus on trying to teach the kids that strong people don't exclude, they include. And again, begin to talk about, again, someday you're going to have a family. Are you going to include? Someday you want to run a company? Do you want a bunch of exclusive cliques within your firm? No. So why don't you start learning how to develop inclusion now? Granted, that's where this is all going.
One of the examples in, I think one of the articles that you wrote on this subject included questions of a place like Enron. Let's say you are an employee. It's not like everybody's a leader. You know, you're an employee. Most of us are employees. Very few people are leaders. And so you're an employee of a company that's doing overtly unethical things. And this is a big, big Wall Street problem because you have cultures of people who truly, in my view, don't really see the rest of the world as being quite as real as they are. All they care about is how their actions
Sure.
affect themselves and their little group. So let's say you're having conversations, ethical conversations with your students about this subject, and they're in a toxic culture. How do you deal with it?
Good question. We actually show at our Student Leadership Institute that we do every June with about 25 of our kids, we actually show excerpts from The Smartest Guys in the Room and use Enron as a test case. And so I guess we stress a couple things on this. First of all, we want them to be cognizant of the idea of a healthy culture versus a toxic culture. So we want our kids, when they're interviewing at a firm, not just to go, this is a famous firm, and boy, people would think highly of me if I worked at this firm. We want them really to go, is this firm a healthy firm? Does this firm have a mission toward its clients, its employees, and its world, or is it really about just generating cash? And if it's just about generating cash, we want them to think, I don't want to work at this firm. And so we really do stress that every person is potentially a leader. I mean, it is a powerful and important part of how we educate. And so at the micro level, which is not necessarily what you're talking about, but every employee can be a leader with their clients or not. They could be a leader with their coworkers or not. They could be the go-to person who helps solve problems that are beyond their own job description. But what we hope is that at the board level, we want people who have the conceptual rhetorical skills that would make them capable in a boardroom where these weird internal corporations that got set up inside of Enron pretty much to mask going into huge debt as something other than that, right? To hide that.
Right.
We would hope our kids would be able to go, wait a minute, what we're doing is radically unsustainable, right? And this is not in the interest of the firm in the long term. Eventually, this won't work. and we could do it for a year, we could do it for 2 years. We're trying to serve our clients and our vendors and the citizens of Houston and the world and ourselves. And we're about to do something that's going to blow that all up. And to make the case and to stand up, to have the courage to do it, but also the wherewithal to give the talk and to deal with pushback. And that woman who ended up being the whistleblower, she stood up, she led, right? And you could say, well, she's not a leader compared to Jeff Skillings or Ken Lay, but she certainly saved the, I mean, obviously the thing blew up. There was no way it wasn't going to by that point, but what a great act she did to stop the carnage, at least when she did. If only somebody else would have viewed him or herself as such a leader earlier to stop it. So that's what we, I mean, that's the multiple ways we deal with that.
Now, your school, the school that you teach at, St. Mark's School in Dallas, is a boys' school. Have you addressed the question of teaching this to co-ed classes?
Yeah, I think a lot of the other schools I've worked with are co-ed. Almost all of them are co-ed. It gives us a slight advantage to be able to say to, you know, to talk about the life of a man and the shift from boy to man. There's a lot of leverage to be able to say, you know, boys are really people who get cared for a lot, but men do a lot of caring. And where are you on that spectrum? Because no boy wants to stay a boy. It's a little harder to talk about child and adult in that way, but virtually everything we're doing has a direct flip to girls as well.
Well, it's also complicated because if you talk about girls get cared for and then women do the caring, well, women do way too much caring in our society.
Well, again, we're trying to, because I don't deal with that on a day-to-day basis, that's not a huge stress of ours. We are trying to transform the dynamic of what a successful man is and looks like from somebody who sort of just sort of an uber monetary phenomenon in their community to somebody who gives great care. There's a huge focus on our whole program to get the kids to realize, again, when you're a 40-year-old man, you're going to get up in the morning and you're going to have spouse, children, clients, coworkers, friends to care for, and it's going to be dominate your day. And so the life of a man is a life of care, and to say, are you ready? How are we going to get you ready to do that? And so for the women, it's going to be that way too. And the question is, are they going to have the full spectrum of ways they can care, right? And that, if I taught at a girls' school, that would be a focus, right? Don't just think you can only be a mother. You could also be these other things too. You could care those ways as well.
Do questions of human nature, what is human nature, come up in these conversations about ethics?
Again, that's a huge question, where to start. We actually ran an 11-teacher interdisciplinary seminar last year with 14 kids on the sociobiology of ethics and leadership, and a lot of us were learning on the fly while we were teaching because it wasn't something that we had in our own backgrounds. But E.O. Wilson's recent book, The Social Conquest of the Earth, was our central text, and we use some of David Brooks's stuff from The Social Animal as well. And I think it's fascinating to study human nature. And again, my own background's in philosophy, where that term historically has been taken as a universal, right? Because the idea came about prior to even any idea that evolution happened. So the nature of something was its eternal principle, right? And I think if you study human nature in terms of evolution, you realize that it has shifted tremendously. And so in E.O. Wilson's book, I mean, there's sort of three overlapping, somewhat conflicting aspects to human nature that have been based on evolution. The first is by individual selection, where every single individual agent for about the last 3.7 billion years has, to some degree, had genes that have pushed it to survive for its own account. And I don't know, in our lineage, maybe 400 million years ago, you start getting kin selection, where families start developing due to sexual reproduction, where because your genes are in your relatives, you will have, and the genes are ultimately calling the shots in all of this, proto-humans would naturally have incentives built into them to care for others, but others being their blood relatives, because your genes are in your blood relatives. So you have, already you have attention, right? You could write your first good novel right there, where you have a conflicting set of impulses in a proto-human to do well for him or herself and to do well for him or her relatives. And you can imagine sibling rivalries being all stoked here. The most interesting thing, though, and this I think gets to the heart of your question, is roughly 2.5 million years ago in the savannas of Africa, once all these pre-adaptations have to happen, but ultimately our ancestors learn how to control fire and they start living around somewhat stable campsites. And they get the first division of labor. And for the first time, they bring other beings, other proto-humans, in from outside their group to be good hunters, to help get firewood, to help guard the campsite. And so for the first time in history, you have a need to cooperate. For the first time in history, the fruits of the hunt are shared with non-hunters and non-blood relatives. And you get the first thing that looks like a society that we have. And that's called group selection. So you have individual selection, kin selection, group selection. And group selection, the logic of it, just to make it clear, because I think it's brilliant and fascinating and nobody knows about it, it's that at that point, it became that groups that lived that way and had learned this sort of basic cooperative skill so outcompeted the other groups that your own interest was to be in that, in such a group. It meant more to your own future evolutionary power to be included in such a group than to be strong or to be fast or right. to be fleet. And so at that point, it becomes in my rational self-interest to care for you if you're in my group. And so one powerful implication of this for the kids was to see that the history of evolution is moving so clearly toward care, toward love. It's ultimately a story. The story of evolution is the story of the expansion of the in-group, if you want to think of it that way. It starts with an in-group of one. It moves toward an in-group of you and your blood relatives, whatever that is. It then moves to an in-group of including the 40 or so people that it seems were living around these early campsites. And again, we try to ask them, as things have developed, what's the in-group now? And try to get them to see, now your in-group is everybody in your English class. It's everybody in the sophomore class that you're in. It's everybody in the school. It's everybody in Dallas. Do you see that you share interests with the people of Dallas? And now that, again, people on the other side of the globe making decisions about what kind of power plant to build are having an effect on you, it's now gone global, right?
Right.
And so I think almost everybody who's in evolution science, evolutionary psychology, sociobiology, cultural anthropology today views the early takes on Darwinism and like the early understandings of Darwinism to be just flat out 180 degrees misguided.
Very, very interesting, because you still hear the kinds of rhetoric about self-interest, whereas the reality that you were talking about to extrapolate is we need healthy oceans in order to have a healthy community of human beings, and that means whales and sharks and fish and everybody else. And you know, it's funny because this whole thing about blood relatives, not blood relatives, I mean, chimpanzees are our blood relatives if you zoom out a little bit.
Right.
All mammals are our blood relatives if you zoom out a little more.
Good. Just to follow up on that, it's again, in the animal kingdom, they've done some pretty spot-on studies that show that for many species, the closer the blood relative, it's not just blood relatives as a group, like literally in the animal kingdom, you can study animals and see that they're far more willing to put their own lives on the line for their own children than they are for their cousins, right?
Right.
And then by the time you're at, what, second cousins, I mean, it's only, what, 1/64th of your genes are in that person. So yes, we're all blood relatives, but I also think to complicate maybe your question and your concern a bit, and it's fascinating, like it's fascinating to now think of like, why are we interested in novels and what makes a good novel, what makes a good movie, that it's not as if group selection has trumped individual selection. All three of those phenomenon are happening, and that we've had 3.7 billion years or so of incentives juiced into our DNA to juice into us as people to compete for our own self-interest. We've had about 400 million years ballpark of kin selection where we have incentives to care for our families. And then we've had about 2.5 million years only, which is not a lot of time compared to 3.7 billion with the group selection. And so when you think about the multiplicity of just inborn genetic incentives, the selfish ones are prominent. And I guess one way we deal with that with the kids is to get them to realize how behind those incentives are compared to the social reality they face today. That they are far, how to put this, they need to train themselves into a second nature. That's the way we put it, right? Where they need to be more, it's in their interest to learn to be more cooperative, right?
But I mean, so many people are already so cooperative if you really look at it. I mean, the number of people who help the children of strangers, the number of people who stop at the side of the road and all of that, it's already, I mean, whatever else is inbred, we have that in our nature as well.
Sure. It's definitely in our nature, and it's also implied in a lot of our education, too. But to be able to speak to a kid, and again, this has been transformative for me in the short run, because I'm more inclined, again, my natural impulse as a teacher, where a kid would be really selfish, would have been 2 years ago, to really hold that kid guilty of being selfish.
Yeah.
And I think now I understand more that may well be just right. It probably is. It's more of a natural tendency that the kid hasn't yet learned needs to be corrected.
Or maybe he's just distressed.
Yeah. When you see boys, I mean, if you were to teach seventh grade or eighth grade and you see how cutthroat competitive children can be at that age, there's clearly something natural going on there that is not healthy and that maybe worked for them back 3 million years ago when things were scarce, and if they didn't fight for every little morsel that they would die.
But it would be interesting for you and for your group as teachers to go visit a school in a completely different culture in a completely different part of the world and see what that looks like, because I think Americans tend to overlay their own culture on their ideas of human nature, and that because of the economic system in which we live that is so cutthroat, we just think that that's the way people are, and it isn't necessarily true everywhere.
Uh-huh. It would be interesting to do that. I get what you mean. My suspicion would be that culturally, certain societies are more ahead of the game than America is in teaching the importance of cooperation, that it's in the water of their societies to teach that earlier and to ameliorate these phenomenon.
Has this curriculum or the way that you're developing it, is it something that you share? I mean, it would be so interesting to bring something like this to a place like Santa Fe, or maybe we already have some of these things going on that I don't know about, but where you've got a genuinely multicultural, economically stratified world. Well, you do in Dallas too, but I mean, you're talking about a kind of elite prep school. To bring something like that to, you know, a rough public school.
It would be great. And SMU has a relatively new education school, which has an incredible director, and they want to transform education in these ways, and they're trying to do what they're doing. Columbia has the Klingenstein Institute, which is doing some of this. Public schools, again, because of the focus on testing, because of talk about a place where a fight for resources and a suspicion about every every way that you're not trying to get Johnny to pass his third grade test in math, it's just a tough sell. Ultimately, would it be great? I think the answer is yes. And again, I've worked with lots of schools. I haven't worked with a public school yet in spreading the word. But my gosh, there's so many independent schools which are in the process of trying to start these programs. And again, because those educators tended not to have had this training themselves, they have this great impetus, but they don't really know how to talk the talk. And so to help them do that is a wonderful thing. And I think you'll see this bloom in the next 5 or 10 years in a real way in the country, that public schools have most of our students and are going to probably get this last is unfortunate.
I know this program is fairly new, but do you have any feedback from your young men who have gone to college about how it's affected their lives? And do you have any way that you're going to kind of evaluate, like, what happens to these people and the world around them 10, 20, 30 years from now?
Those are great questions. I think the answers are yes. Obviously, it is early stages. We have just a lot of great feedback while the kids are still at school, but then they go off to college, and everybody has noticed that the kids come back. You know, it used to take 5, 6, 7 years, and the kids would start coming back and visiting teachers. Now they come back at Thanksgiving, at Christmas, at spring break. They feel a really close connection, and they're just really aware and grateful for what the school's done for them. And that's a huge thing we want the kids to be aware of, regardless of what community they're in, that what they owe to it. But they also come back and they do comment that it's different in college. They don't feel that their colleges are trying to teach them any of this stuff that they learned in high school. And many of their peers and their friends, they have no real vocabulary to think this through.
Often, to think about ethics, to think about self-interest being broader than just their own.
That's right. And, you know, when they hit junior year, they start looking to go work for consultancies and finance companies, and which is fine, but that they can't even really have discussions about how it could be any different. One thing about our school, the annual giving has skyrocketed for alums. It's at 56%, which is 18 is the national average, so it's three times the national average. And the young alums, which at most schools, you know, you sort of write off the young alums and then gradually they start giving as they get older. Our young alums give between like 60 and 70% for every graduating class since we started the program, which is sort of just like nobody's ever seen anything like it before. But I would say one of the best pieces of evidence is that the kids are coming back after they graduate. One of the, you know, it's just so hard to measure the kind of things you're asking about. Like, how do you measure community involvement and service? As adults in the bigger community beyond the school, one great thing we're seeing is that the alums are coming back to Dallas. Again, people have huge loyalty to Texas and they have huge loyalty to Dallas. So many of the boys do come back and work in businesses in Dallas. And they're coming back to school and starting probing, like, can we still do, will you set up community service for us? We don't quite know how to get involved as adults. And so that's a really neat opportunity going forward that we're just starting to work with. Obviously, it would involve expanding our community service program to have a bunch of adults, but that would keep them connected to each other and the school and to our current students and to Dallas. So we're looking at that as a huge opportunity going forward. And, you know, if we have a big percentage of alums working through our school to take care of Dallas as adults, that will be a great sign that it's a success.
Do you think that there will be any kind of like study by the school or by whoever 10, 15, 20 years from now?
I think we'll probably do surveys. So much of what we know, it's almost like in your own family, you have a good sense of if things are going right or wrong. And so we have a strong sense because we know each other so well and we know the alums so well. We have a strong sense as to what people's thoughts are and what their feelings are about their experience. Again, we haven't formalized like how to make a questionnaire or a poll to ask people to self-evaluate what this has meant to them. We do have lots of evidence with our current alums who graduated, you know, like our trustees and who graduated a decade ago or two decades ago. When they hear us talk about this program, they love it. I mean, they're just like, we never had anything like this when I was at the school. And these are the exact issues that make or break my day every day as a man. And it's just bizarre that in hindsight, we never learned this. And so they're really, really excited about it and eager to support the program.
Martin Stegmuller is a teacher and curriculum coordinator for the Leadership and Ethics Program at the St. Mark's School in Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.